You're listening to the Pulled by the Root podcast.
Welcome, everyone, to the Pulled by the Root podcast. Oh, my gosh, I was up all night reading Set Free, a childhood memoir by Destiny McAllister, who is our guest today. And I could not put this book down for 3 days. I've actually, you can't see it if you're on the podcast, but hopefully on YouTube. This book looks like it's 100 years old from me just loving on it for the last 3 days. It was so compelling. Destiny, she's a miracle. Her story is absolutely riveting. It's inspiring. I would like to read your bio and then talk a little bit more about one of the images I saw in Destiny's book. And then we're just going to jump right in and talk to Destiny about her journey. Destiny is a former foster youth and adoptee, but most of all, she is a Christian, a wife of 18 years and a mother to 3 wonderful children. She is passionate about using her story to help others to find healing and learn more about foster care and adoption. Destiny's most recent endeavor was the publication of her memoir, Set Free, in May of 2020. Set Free is Destiny's personal childhood memoir that begins at her birth and ends with the birth of her first child at age 23. Her extensive case file with Child Protective Services began when she was 7 months old due to the abandonment by her biological mother and the state of health she was left in. Though there was continued abuse happening throughout her early years, Child Protective Services was not involved again until she told a school counselor what was happening at the age of 12. At that time, she was placed into foster care. Her story starts out tragically and was full of unexpected twists and turns. However, her childhood ends just in the nick of time, full of hope for her to have a bright future into her adult years. She is living proof of what can happen in someone's life when a vulnerable teen is offered a loving family and a support system to belong to. Destiny's intention in writing her memoir was to give an inside look into the mind of a child experiencing layers of childhood trauma. It is her heart to advocate and give a voice to others who share similar stories. She continues to have a close relationship with her adoptive parents while also reconnecting with her recently found biological family. The publication of Set Free was the first in many ways Destiny hopes to advocate for foster youth and adoptees, as it is her passion to help other survivors of childhood trauma to find hope and healing. Oh, Destiny, welcome. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you so much.
Okay. So I was telling Destiny that I'm probably going to cry a lot during this interview because her story is so fresh in my heart. But as I'm reading her story, I didn't really expect images to be in this book. And I came upon an image of Destiny. She's laying on what looks to be like some kind of a bedspread. And I have never, ever seen a baby's backside so horribly like destroyed by a diaper rash, just the neglect. And it's just shocking to see this, Destiny. And then to also get to the end of your book and see where your life ended up, just the contrast of those things and the miracle that is. And I just wonder, I know it's difficult to go back and explore all these memories, but I think it's really important for people to understand the reality so that they can understand the miracle. What happened to you to get you to that quilt laying face down in that situation? Like, can you start with that?
Yeah. So, my mother was 18 when she had me, and she had already had another child. She got married to the man listed on my birth certificate as my father, just a couple months after she was pregnant with me. And from what I understand, from talking to her and other people that were around at that time, is that they struggled in their marriage very, very early on. And so they were separated for a period of time. And they were very poor. And I don't know what all, if there's drugs or alcohol or what, I'm not sure about that. But there was definitely neglect going on. And I know that, Her mother, which is my grandmother, came over and found me in such a horrible condition with a really bad diaper rash. And she tried to offer her advice to like get me to the doctor or like buy diaper rash creams and things like that. But it was just continuing to get worse. And then it eventually led to my biological mother leaving me with the man listed on my birth certificate, him and his family. I don't think that they realized that she wasn't coming back. But she didn't. She didn't come back after that. So family did take me to the hospital, and it was, you know, not just the severe diaper rash, but it was malnutrition and failure to thrive. And they were like, you know, she's not going to live. And, you know, the thing that I find very curious is, you know, why wasn't anybody held accountable? You know?
I think that's the thing about your story. Like when I was reading it, you would go through one terrible thing and I would think, okay, whew, she's done. That has to be the worst possible thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it just felt like it never stopped.
I do have, it's not like I think, oh, you know, my biological mother, you know, she should have been in trouble or whatever. It's not so much of that as I think, where was the support? I mean, clearly she wasn't capable of taking care of me. Where was the support system, and why weren't they tracking her down to say, you know, this isn't okay just to walk away from your baby and leave your baby this way? You know, I mean, she needed help. Like, do you want us to help you take care of your baby, or what kind of supports do you need? Or, you know, if they found that she, you know, was definitely just not capable, she was on drugs or something like that, then you deal with that. Like, where was the support, not just for me, but for her, you know? So that's kind of
exactly. Yeah. And it left you vulnerable. And, you know, since we're talking about your biological mom, I think it'd be really interesting. Like, when was the next time she came into your life? Were you like, when do you remember seeing her again or having her involved?
Well, I ended up living with who I thought was my father. And he married, and I thought that his new wife was my mother until I was 7. And that's when they told me that she wasn't my biological mother and that my biological mother had abandoned me. And then, you know, I had all kinds of questions, but there wasn't any answers, and I wasn't allowed to talk about her. And so I just, you know, there's just a lot of like me just wondering in my own little world, you know, about her. And I never felt angry with her. I just had questions. Whenever I was 12 years old, DHS had continued to be involved in my life for a few years. And then we moved around so much that DHS just like disappeared, it seemed like. And then whenever I was 12 years old, I told the school counselor that I was being sexually abused at home by my father. And that's when I was put into foster care. And very soon after that is whenever I was like, I want to find my mother. And so I had my public defender helped me locate her. She was pretty easy to find, even though she was living a few states away. And so when I was 13 years old, I went to go live with her. It was a pretty wild deal because she came in, she drove in one evening to Oklahoma from Alabama, and I met her one evening, And then the next day, I met her in court and she signed papers for me to take me home with her. And then later that evening, she came and picked me up from my grandparents' house. And I went to go live with her for 6 weeks. And I mean, it was so strange because, you know, there's a lot of, features that I could see myself in her. And it, you know, that was the first time that I had ever really like been like, oh, you know, that's a person that kind of looks like me. But she was a stranger. She was a complete stranger, you know, and I felt like it was extremely difficult to connect, you know, with her. And she wasn't mean, but she wasn't really like loving and caring. Like she wasn't just like, you know, she just wasn't like super like nurturing. And so I just found it very difficult to connect with her. But then after a 6 week period, I needed to fly back to Oklahoma to testify against my father who had that, you know, for the sexual abuse. And the day after I got back on the plane, then my mother called me and said, I've decided I don't want you to come back here. So that was extremely shocking.
Destiny, when I read that in your book, that was such a difficult thing. And there were a couple of things in there that really stood out to me about your experience with your bio mom. When you were in the closet with her,
mm-hmm.
and you received the piece of clothing, which I'd really love for you to talk about. And also yeah. when she washed your hair, like,
yeah.
I don't know if you can address those before.
I remember just trying to connect with her. And it was just like, there was a wall, you know, between us. And then, the morning that I was to fly out, I had come out, I had, you know, just taken a shower and blow dried my hair and everything. And I was like, okay, you know, I'm ready to go. And, she said, oh, I want to wash your hair. And I was like, well, I just washed my hair. And she's like, no, I want to wash your hair for you. And it was just odd, but you know, I was like, okay. And I remember, you know, her washing my hair in the kitchen sink. And I mean, it was just that was, sorry, man. that was the only time, that I ever remember any kind of like motherly affection from her. So, you know, just kind of, you know, even though it's just so many years ago, it's just, I think, you know, what it really boils down to is just normalcy. And I think that's, you know, that's what we're seeking, is that we want to feel normal and we want to feel like, you know, we're in normal situations. And, you know, for me, I knew from a very young age that, you know, my mother abandoned me and that wasn't normal. And so that little moment of her washing my hair in the sink, you know, that was just a taste of normal, you know, a taste of what I imagine normal would be like, you know what I'm saying?
I do, Destiny. And I think about, you know, you touched on your stepmom and I think the contrast, you know, she was really rough with you and would hurt you with your hair and then to have that moment of tenderness with your mom, and then to have then the next moment she's making these decisions. It's just, I mean, yeah. your spirit is so mighty to be able to withstand all of that.
It's a lot. And I think it's just going to take my whole lifetime to process, you know? So
yes, Well, before we move on to the next thing, can you tell us a little more about the green card again? Because that really stuck out to me as well.
Uh-huh.
Like that moment when you were in the closet.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll mention here that we did just move and I have boxes everywhere, and I'm kind of sorting things between like keepsakes and things that I have to go in the attic and whatnot. And I just happened to have that cardigan.
Yes.
And I wasn't even like planning. It's just like I have this keepsake box right here and in my room with me. So I'm going to grab that real quick just so I can kind of.
Yes. Like, yes, please.
It's just, it's kind of this olive green. It's not super beautiful, but this is it. The story about that is that my biological mother was doing laundry one day, and, I just saw this piece of clothing laying there and I picked it up, and she says, oh, she's like, do you like that? And I was like, oh yeah, I really like it. She goes, well, you can have it. And it was like, she didn't like give it to me like, oh, like this is sentiments from me, you know, here. No, she just was like, well, you can have it. But I'm 37 years old and I still have it. So that says a lot. Because, you know, it's the only thing, you know, that I've ever had, that was hers. And, going through my teen years after I had, you know, 13, you know, on, you know, in my earlier high school years, I remember that I would wear it to school, and whenever, you know, I missed her, then I would wear it. And, you know, that was all I had. And so, after I got married, you know, I just hung it in the back of my closet. And it's hung there for years and years. And so, you know, with this move, and there's been a lot of things that's happened in the last couple of years that it's helped me to like process my trauma. And so, so I'm not going to throw the green cardigan away, but the green cardigan is going to go in a keepsake box in the attic. So it's baby steps, you know.
Yeah.
It's baby steps to let go. And and I think that it's important to people that really like know her, or know like a little bit more details of my story. I think they just like don't understand, like, you know, why do you still care about her, and like what is it, like why don't you just hate her guts, you know? You know, it's pretty difficult, but I don't think that it is really her as a person that I have a longing for. I think that, or that I'm trying to make excuses for her, abusive behavior towards me. But I think it's the sense, it truly is just that sense of normalcy, you know? And it's who I would hope that she could be, right? But it's not. But who I hope that she could be and who she is completely two different people. So it's taken many years to get to the point and to accept that, you know, and to accept that person that I wish that she could be. Which is just a normal, loving, caring mother, it's not reality, and it's never going to be, you know? And so, but it's very, very difficult to just completely let go. Really, you're letting go of hope, you know what I'm saying? So
I do, Destiny, and yeah. I'm like having a maternal reaction to you, and I'm just going to speak my heart. You're just so beautiful. And I just think she missed out on something so amazing, because you are a precious gift. And I'm just sorry for your pain. And I appreciate you sharing it, because I think people that are adopted and fostered, they need to be understood. Their behavior. What I love too about your book is that when you're reading it, all of a sudden you would just give the sage wisdom in there and really make me think about it in a different way. Just this beautiful advice to say, if you're in contact with a child who's in distress, who's in this situation, mm-hmm. here are some things you can do to help. And I think by exposing yourself in such a vulnerable way, it really allows people to hopefully have empathy. And you know, I think about, you know, you had mentioned the sexual abuse, and I think a lot of adoptees and foster experience that, and that was so difficult to read about and to hear, and how you were finally able to break free from that is incredibly inspiring. And the thing that I'm learning too is that it's very confusing to be in that kind of a situation as a child. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could speak about that in a way that makes you feel comfortable, whether it's an advisory way or the way that, you know, you were treated, whatever you feel on your heart, because there are a lot of misconceptions about that issue. Like, why would you defend someone like that? Or why,
right, exactly.
You know, I don't know what you can speak to about that, but I think it could be really helpful.
I think what would be the most helpful to explain it is something that I had wrote about trauma bonding.
Yes, I agree.
And I did write about trauma bonding in my book too. And you know, I definitely didn't understand this as a child, and really didn't until a couple of years ago. You think that there's something very wrong with you to not have a reaction, you know, if somebody's trying to harm you, that you would bat them away and scream and run away or something, you know, like that seems like the logical, like the normal reaction. And so when you don't have that kind of reaction, or you know that you didn't have that reaction, then you start to feel shamed. And that's where you carry a lot of the shame, and you start to think that, you know, what's wrong with me? Like, am I broken? Like that I didn't respond, you know, how I should have responded. But when you start to understand trauma bonding, then it starts to make a lot of sense. And for me, I think that it just, everything is connected. And because my father, it's so difficult because he's not my father. but when I was a child, he was the only father that I knew. And I thought that he was my biological father. So at that time period of my life, I knew that my mother had left me and abandoned me. And I thought that he was the only a biological parent that stuck with me and decided to keep me and thought that I was worthy to keep. And so, you know, it was very confusing. I'm trying to figure out how I want to say this, because it's pretty complicated, but you know, I felt like he did something so good to me by keeping me and not abandoning me too. And so that's really kind of where that bond started. And then when he is, you know, when he would be like abusing me, then, you know, for me, like I would just freeze and I couldn't comprehend in the moment, like what's happening. And so I would literally just shut down and freeze. But I didn't want to tell on him or scream or whatever, because I felt indebted to him, because he kept me and he didn't abandon me like my mother. You know,
Destiny.
It's very complicated, you know.
It is so complicated. And if I can just interject a few things here, because when I was reading about this in your book, I think there were a few really powerful descriptions that you gave. And I think the red balloon was so significant to me because it was your way of surviving it. And mm-hmm. that disassociation. And also, yeah, and also the thing that really struck me was you said, if only my house were glass, mm-hmm. and that somebody could see, because according to what I read, you tried to tell. So I just think a lot of people can probably relate to those imagery, you know, that imagery and the sensation of detaching from your body. And I think when you said that you knew that you had to come back down, like, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think
it was
super helpful to.
Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely dissociation. So whenever I say like I would freeze, then, you know, my body would freeze, but like in mentally in my mind, it's like I would just kind of like float up. And then just kind of like separate, you know, myself. And then, I couldn't stay there forever. And I, you know, had to come back, you know, and face reality. And in which, you know, as a child, you just, you know, you can't, it's too difficult. It's too difficult to process. And I think that's why a lot of kids, do end up disassociating, because that's too much for the brain to be able to handle and to process.
People are encouraged to tell, you know, and you have to be brave enough to tell your experience. And I think the glass house, and then if you go and tell someone and they don't respond to you, then you're right back in that same position where you have that conflict. Here's a person that saved me who's also destroying me at the same time. Like,
exactly. So I think that, you know, the image that, of the glass house is really just saying, like, I wish that, somebody could have just really known what was happening and rescued me by, you know, like just seeing like, oh no, I got to help instead of me, you know, it was all on me to be like faced with, the agony of reporting and, you know, getting him in trouble. I mean, as a child, that was extremely difficult, because like I said before, you know, we had that trauma bond where it's like, you know, sometimes he was just so kind and such a good loving parent and everything. And then he wasn't. And so it was just that back and forth, you know? And it just seemed like in my mind, every time I would think, okay, like I'm gonna say something, then, and he wouldn't even know that I was going to say something, then all of a sudden he would do something. I mean, even as a kid, you know, for him doing something kind of might be like, hey, you want me to take you for an ice cream? You know, like, and so, you know, that's kindness, you know, when you're a kid and, oh, well, dad's taking me for ice cream. I can't tell on him today. You know what I'm saying? It's just even those little things. That's the way that it is when you're a child, experiencing that type of abuse and abusive relationship. So, and also just not knowing, just, you know, what's going to happen. Like if I had told my stepmom multiple times, but I think it's just denial, it's just deep denial, like that, you know, this can't be happening. And which I think is a very common scenario, but also for me, like if I tell somebody outside the family, what's going to happen? What's going to happen to me? What's going to happen to my family? So is things going to really get better, or could it possibly get worse? I mean, it's all scary. So, but ultimately I had come to the conclusion that I wanted it to stop, and, I wanted him to get help. So he was, using drugs. I'm trying to think of the word that I want to use, but he would huff lacquer thinner was his drug of choice. He worked in the in carpentry, so it was very accessible. And he would come home high, and sometimes that's whenever I would be abused, and then sometimes I knew that he wasn't high, and that was just, you know, a choice that he was making. So there was also many years there that I kept in my mind going, well, he, you know, I was making excuses for him and saying, well, he wouldn't do that. He wasn't high, and playing things down, you know, which is really common too. But, But no, like he literally, he needed help, and I needed to be out of that situation. So I had to, I had no choice but to advocate for myself and, to tell the school counselor. So, which I'm so thankful that I did.
I'm so thankful too, Destiny. And I know that was a really hard, thing to talk about, but I think the more we shine the light on the truth, then people will hopefully be able to have more compassion, and there can be easier access to help in these complicated things, you know.
Right.
And just to divert a little, just to try to give you a little bit of a break.
Okay.
There is something so beautiful that you were named. And can you tell us about like the tribe you're from and how you got your name? I just love it. Like, I don't think my name would be what your name is. I think it'd be more like Little Annoyer
or something. Oh, whatever. well, you know, that little story there is actually a story that that I always laughed about whenever, you know, and then in the book, I think that it comes across like a little bit more like serious, but it is something that I actually think is pretty funny. So when I was a little girl, I was part of the Miama Indian tribe, and that was through, you know, the father listed on my birth certificate. And so there was times that I went to like Indian camps and stuff like that. And there was one camp that I went to that the Indian chief came and his whole like, you know, gear and everything. And he called all the children out to kind of this big open area. And he had like a peace pipe, and there was like all this like smoke in the air and stuff. And I mean, culturally speaking, you know, it's a really neat memory. But he gave all of the children their Indian names that day. And whenever it came my turn, he said, this one's really special. He said, your name is Little Dove. And so my name was Little Dove. And and I don't know, like, it's just so like funny to me. But as an adult, I went back, and first of all, I found out as an adult going through ancestry.com and going through Union and learning about who my actual biological father is. I ended up finding out that I obviously wasn't part of the Miami Indian tribe. I was actually through my mother, part of the Chickasaw Nation tribe. So as an adult, I switched tribes. So I don't know if I can really like keep that Indian name, you know.
I like it a lot. I noticed above step three on the title, for those of you that can't see it, it looks like there's a little dove or yes, bird. Yeah, I'm just going with dove right
it does.
Now.
Which it I does. Think is, it kind of goes with
which
it.
I think.
But yeah. Also that name, you know, is kind of interesting because he, you know, that Indian chief, he didn't know anything about my life, and that name Little Dove is something that is not just with the Miami Nation, but with other Indian tribes, and it means like one that will find their way back home. And you know, that, you know, I mean, the way that relates, you know, with my story and everything is pretty big. So
yeah, definitely. That was just such a beautiful thing to just experience with you. And I don't want to give too much of your book away, but basically in summary, I mean, things just continued to get worse for you, and you were moved around a lot, and the trauma just kept getting layered. And yeah, I just want to touch on a couple of difficult things, and then we need to leap into the hopeful part of this, because this is, you know, very important that we speak about where you are now as well.
Yes, absolutely.
But I think another thing really stuck out to me, you know, when you were having a really, really dark moment, we shared before we recorded that I had one of the ballerina jewelry boxes with the ballerina spins. And when my family was arguing, I would twist a little and listen to the music and watch the ballerina and just try to get lost in that moment. And when I saw the image in your book of your ballerina, I didn't expect to read what I read. And if you can share that, that would be, I think that'd be really powerful for people to know that there are these dark corners, but there's also light.
You know, the height of my trauma in my, you know, what I refer to as my first family, you know, I felt like very alone, and I didn't know what to do. I wanted the abuse to stop. My stepmother, it was like, she would kind of believe me right when I first tell her. And then the next day it was like, she didn't. And so it was just, it just felt very lonely, and I just felt, you know, very hopeless. And so at 12 years old, I had a jewelry box sitting on my dresser, and I was just, had decided that I wanted to end my life. And, I was trying to find something sharp in my room. I pulled the little ballerina, like pulled it out, and that the bottom part of that is really, really sharp. And that's what I was going to use, to like cut my wrist with. And, I was like right there and like pushing in and, you know, getting ready to begin. And then I just like, just something just told me like, no, like you've got to hold on. Like things are going to get better. And so, yeah, so it, you know, the jewelry box and like those pretty spinning ballerinas and the little, I think they usually play like It's a Small World After All, like that is, you know, a pretty triggering thing for me, now, because that was such a dark moment, you know, that things could have been very different. So.
Yeah. And I know it's such a hard thing to talk about, and you know, learning that adoptees are four times more likely to take their lives. You know, it's definitely a subject that sadly a lot of us are familiar with. And I'm so glad that you're still here, Destiny, because what I think is so extraordinary about your circumstances is when you were in your last foster placement, you made a really brave choice surrounding church and faith, and that changed the trajectory of your life. And I think it would be really great to go from this really dark moment into that space, because you just have to speak it. It's just beautiful.
I will say that as a child, off and on, we would go to different churches, and I had grandparents that were, that went to church pretty regularly. And so, you know, I was familiar with Christianity. But once I got into teen years and in foster care and, you know, just the layers of trauma, I was just like, I don't believe in anything anymore, you know? And at 15, I started to go through a phase where I just believed in, like horoscopes and, you know, like superstitious stuff. But I had this one friend that I met in vocal music that went to like a different school. We were, you know, one of those little like competition things. We met there, and he became a really, really good friend of mine. And he would always talk to me about Jesus. He was surprised to know that I didn't believe in anything. But I would talk to him a little bit about my life, and what my circumstances were. And he just kept encouraging me, you know, like, you need to, you know, turn this over to Jesus. Like, he can help you. And he kept talking to me about, like, you know, hope and the hope that could be found, in Jesus. So, you know, I got to a point that I just was like, okay, fine. Like, I'm going to give it a try. I'm going to give Jesus a try. And
why not?
Why not? Right. And so I at that time I was living with, in a kinship placement. So it was an aunt that eventually turned out to not be like a biological aunt, but we didn't know that at the time. And I had been living with her almost 2 years. And it just, I think that I seemed like I was doing fine on the outside, but I was learning to like go, you know, just pull a lot inward. And so I still felt, you know, very alone and everything. And I remember praying a prayer, asking God if he could hear me, that would he please help me in my future, and help me that, you know, I would trust him, you know, all the days of my life. And so I said this prayer, and then within 5 minutes, my aunt came into my room, and she sat on my bed, and she told me, you know, I don't know why I feel so strongly about this, but I believe that it's time for you to find a different family to live with. And I mean, I thought that I was going to live there like forever, you know, like until I got married and or went to college or whatever. And so it was very shocking. And even though, I mean, it was another rejection, but I also just prayed that prayer. And so I immediately connected that and said, this is how God's helping me. And this is what's meant to be. And this is God's way of helping me in my future. So I didn't fight it, and I didn't even cry or anything. I was just like, okay. And I just accepted it. And, you know, at that point in my life, like that specific point was what, you know, lit a fire of faith within me. And it has really carried me through. So I ended up going to a foster family. I was a single foster mom after that. And then I was researching and just really trying to, you know, figure out what church I wanted to go to. And so I ended up being baptized, and that baptism into the Church of Christ ended up causing that foster mom to tell me that I needed to find a new family to live with as well, because she didn't agree with what I had chosen. And so then again, I was like, okay. And so that's what put me in contact with the next foster family I lived with. And I immediately loved them, and I felt safe with them. And, you know, we shared the same faith and belief and doctrine and everything. So it was a really good fit, I guess. And, I was 17 at that point, and I started becoming very scared about my future. I'm not just like a super independent person. And so I just couldn't picture myself being on my own once I aged out of the system. And I was thinking about, like, you know, one day I might want to have children, and who's going to be my children's grandparents, and, you know, who's going to be my family, like, you know, even after I turn 18. And so I asked them if they would adopt me. And within about 6 months, they did adopt me. So I was adopted 5 months before I turned 18. And, you know, now, like, that's my parents, and that's my children. You know, that's Grammy and Papa. So,
yeah, Destiny. I mean, this is the part where it's just so beautiful, because you really did take a leap of faith, and there was something you wrote about when you walked into, I think you walked into the church, and you just went up to them when you needed a family and said, "Hey."
Yeah. So, yeah.
I just love that part. I'm like, I don't know. That was just such a leap of faith.
Yeah. So, right. So whenever my foster mom had told me, like, you know, you're going to have to find a new family to live with. Then, yeah, it was the next morning. Then I walked up, my friend said, "Oh, you know, there's this couple that goes to church with us, and they weren't able to have children, and they're just, you know, so nice. And maybe, you know, they would be willing to become your foster parents." And so I was like, okay, well, you know, I got to give it a try. And so
just like Jesus. I like this, Destiny.
So yeah, so I went up to Denise right after her services, and was just like, hi, so, you know, I had like shaken hands with her like maybe like once before. But I told her, I was like, you know, my little like 5 minute, like really short, like this is what happened and whatever. So I was just wondering if you guys could become my foster family. And she was just like, whoa, okay. She's like, I wanted to talk to Russell about that. So, the thing is that, I'm really a pretty reserved, more quiet person. But there's definitely times in my life that I really had no choice but to be brave and just advocate for myself, you know? So,
yeah. And I think anyone listening to this, who's hesitating about being a foster parent, especially to teens, just to see the way that that changed your life. And I think there's a lot of misconceptions around foster kids. And I think if we understood more about why they act out, it would be less frightening. Mm-hmm. And I just think it definitely changed your life to be able to have them in it.
Right.
And then we have to move to your beautiful husband, you know, and how that's just so great, Destiny. Then we'll kind of end with that.
Okay. Yeah. So, and I do want to say just one more thing about, the, you know, fostering. I think that you can't, foster children have generally been through many things that maybe other kids haven't been through that aren't foster children. Now, not to say everybody, because there's a lot of like unreported abuse and things. But, you know, yeah, I mean, there's times that they're just really misunderstood. So I think that if you're going to become a foster parent, or even an adoptive parent, I think you really have to do the work and become trauma informed and realize, you know, what are trauma responses versus what are just negative behaviors, so that you can really help that child, you know, become the best that they can be. So
thank you. Thank you for that.
Yeah. So, let's see. So whenever I got married, is that the next?
Well, I just love that you have been able to build a beautiful family and a healthy marriage. I really feel like that's a miracle too, because of what you've been through. And I think it also gives people great hope for what is possible for them. So you can just speak about it with whatever way you'd like.
Yeah.
To.
So, I got married whenever I was 19. So I hadn't really lived with my adoptive family very long before I started dating my husband. But he's 7.5 years older than I am. And so he was just kind of in a different, you know, he was already like into his career and I was just graduating high school. So it felt really scary getting married, but we were both very committed, and my parents, you know, had a lot of conversations with us about, you know, the seriousness of that commitment, and that you can't just have a squabble and walk away. Like, you know, you're going to have to work through it and everything. And, you know, that felt really, really scary to me, because my life was full of like, well, if there's a little bit of friction, then it just dissolves, and like, you know, I get abandoned, or, you know, people just walk away. And so, but I always wanted stability. And so I was willing to work for it. And I think, you know, that's absolutely what I found in my marriage, is just stability. And my husband is extremely patient. And
so he's
very, very understanding. And I have learned a whole lot about myself and my trauma responses, and have been able to just communicate that with him. And so he's really, really compassionate, and we understand so whenever I said before about like adoptive parents and foster parents being trauma informed, it's also a good idea for spouses to become trauma informed.
Can we underline right? that and put an exclamation point? Yeah, I think that's such a really important point to make, Destiny, because I think sometimes that gets left out of the equation. What does it mean for the children that we have if we decide to parent? And what does it mean for the people that are marrying us? And, right. You know, they can look at us pushing back as rejection when it's actually a trauma response to, exactly. to protect. Mm-hmm. And I think that's absolutely right. The more understanding that we have that, oh, this is why I'm doing this. And then he understands that's why she's doing this.
Yes.
Then it can be worked through and not defined as something else. Because right. it's not that we don't want to be loved. We don't want to be hurt. We don't want to be left. Because yeah. I've been accused of having a few walls up.
Yeah.
Just a few. Yeah. So thank you for making, and Destiny, oh my gosh, I could talk to you all day. We have to have you back if you're willing, because there's so many more things I would like to cover with you. You know, we haven't talked about reunion with you or any of those things with, you know, the other side of your biological family. And but just as we end here, is there anything else that you would like to say? Hopefully we have the ears and the hearts and the minds of a lot of different types of people. And I don't know what encouragement you can give them or how you would like to, you know, wrap it up, but I just like to give you the floor.
Right. I was going to say too, that like as an adult with a history of a lot of trauma, I very much understand. And I want everybody to understand that I think that, you know, everybody, has some layer of trauma, you know, somewhere in their life. And it's not anybody else's responsibility to carry that except for you. You know, you're responsible for your own, you know, trauma responses and whatever. And it's not an excuse, you know, to hurt other people. But like our spouses and our support people around us, you know, for them, it's a plea for them to stay like patient and kind and caring and just listen. And so, you know, the way that I've worked with the people around me is I do the work on myself, and, you know, I figure out, okay, like how could I have responded better to, you know, whatever. And then I communicate that. That's my responsibility to communicate that with people, to the people around me. Okay, I think I responded that way because of this, and you know, and I'm sorry, and can you help me next time? You know, be like, I'll give you an example. Is, you know, sometimes when people just aren't listening, like I just, like, you know, kids just don't always listen to their parents, you know, and for me, like that is like a huge trigger for me, because I know, because as a child, I just felt like I wasn't being heard. And so I can sometimes be on top of that, but then there's other times that I'm just like, how come I'm not, you know, why is anybody listening to me? And I overreact. And so, you know, in that moment, I need to be like, you know what, guys, I know why I overreacted and I'm sorry. And then like, maybe they, next time, if they see me doing that, they say, you know, could this be a trigger, instead of like, oh, I just can't stand it when you act like that. You know what I'm saying? They can react more compassionate. You know what I'm saying?
So, oh, Desi, I think that
makes sense, but.
Oh my gosh. It makes so much sense to me, because I think a lot of times we try to be strong for our kids, or we try to hide the emotion or whatever, but I think it's really important.
It's huge.
Yeah. To let, I'm having a bad day. I had a strong reaction. This is why. And then they know why. And it all gets put into context. And I think it's a real gift we give.
They're building huge empathy for people, you know, as they grow up. And and then also I did want to say that I do have a really good relationship with my adoptive family. Aww. So, I'm really, really thankful for that. And I just, when you talk about biological family and adoptive family, it can be very difficult, because I think that it can easily be perceived as that, well, you just can't move on. You can't accept your adoptive family, or that you're ungrateful to your adoptive family, or something like that. And it is two separate things altogether. So,
you know what? Another great point, Destiny. I think that a lot of people don't understand that aren't adopted or come from a foster system. It's like, not that you have two lives, but there are these two distinct categories, your bio family and your adopted family. And those two exist in an adoptee's world. There's no way to erase either one, but we don't just show up on this planet. We have a history that comes up behind us. And if we're denying either of those things, we're denying who we really are inside of that space. So I thank you that maybe you do need to write another book. That was really good. Oh my gosh. I so enjoyed our conversation. And I know there were a lot of tears cried and you did a lot of soul bearing. And I know you'll probably need a big fat nap after this. And I just really appreciate you, Destiny. And I just wish you continued healing. Thank you for healing others too. And I hope we get to talk again.
Yes, me too. It's so nice to meet you, Heidi.
Oh, it's so nice to meet you too.